Okay, we are in Mark 14. 13, we had Jesus explaining what it would be like at the end of the church age, the trials and the problems and stuff like that. This chapter actually has some of the stuff that Jesus has been predicting coming true. He's talking about his betrayal and his being delivered up and all that stuff. It records the final events that leads up to his betrayal and part of the sham trial, or at least at the very start of it, that the Jewish leaders in Rome put on. We also see in this one how Jesus was treated throughout his ordeal. And that's what we're going to look at. He went from being loved in Bethany at the beginning to being condemned in Pilate's court at the end. A lot of things happened in between all that. But we'll start with how he was welcomed and loved in Bethany. So let's go with Mark 14, verses 1 and 2.
After 2 days, it was the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And the chief priests and the scribes sought how they might take him by trickery and put him to death. But they said, not during the feast, lest it be an uproar of the people.
All right, so what we are looking at here is the Friday. This took place on Friday before his triumphal entry is where this takes place. The religious leader knew that they could catch Jesus in Jerusalem because he would be showing up at the Passover, but they were still in fear of the crowds. They were always afraid of the crowds that Jesus seemed to draw and that seemed to really like listening to him. So let's go with verse 3.
And being in Bethany and the house of Simon the leper, as he sat at meat, there came a woman having an alabaster box of ointment of spikenard, very precious, and she broke the box and poured it on his head.
All right. Jesus arrived here on Friday. He was going to rest on the Sabbath, and then he was going to continue his journey to Jerusalem and the cross. The woman with the ointment is not named here, nor is she named in Matthew, which has the same account, but she is in John. So let's go to John 11. Somebody read verses 1 and 2, and you'll see what woman this is.
11, 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. And many believed on him there. Now a certain man was sick, named Lazarus of Bethany, the house of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary which anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick.
All right, so this is actually Mary, the sister of Lazarus. But there is another account of a woman doing very similar thing. And believe it or not, the owner of that house, his name was Simon also. Yeah. But there are two different women because, if you notice this one, this was Simon the leper. He had been healed by Jesus. The other, though, was Simon, who was a Pharisee. So the other Simon was a Pharisee. And this one is Mary, the sister of Lazarus. And that lady there was a converted harlot. So don't confuse the two. They're kind of hard to keep straight because there are so many details the same, but they are two different times. Spikenard was an expensive ointment that was usually imported from India, and the entire portion that she used was roughly equivalent to the annual pay of a common worker.
Wow.
So she gave it willingly to Jesus because she loved him. She loved him, and he was going to go die for her. So anyway, let's go with 4 and 5 and see what the disciples thought.
And there were some that had indignation within themselves and said, why was the waste of the ointment made? For it might have been sold for more than 300 pence and have been given to the poor, and they murmured against her.
All right, so we know that this complaint was led by Judas from other passages. The disciples and Judas, though, they considered this a waste. They were looking at the money value. Like I say, Judas was probably the antagonist and was using this moment for what? What's Judas's motive here in complaining about this woman's wasting his oil?
Ointment.
Hmm? No. No, I mean, that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to sell and steal the money. There's no doubt about that. But no, what's he... Why is he making a big deal of it? It's already happened. Not like he's going to be able to steal it now. It already happened. Why is he upset after the fact that he's making a big deal? Oh, he wanted to prove how righteous he was. He wanted to make it look like he was higher minded and more holy than other people. Something to keep in mind, though, that a lot of people use false righteousness to hide an ulterior motive or agenda. Mm-hmm. Keep that in mind when you see people. Just because you, like Jesus talked about the Pharisees and the priests who pray in public so people will be impressed. That's a whitewashed tomb is what he called them. White on the outside, dead on the inside. So, but he was probably wanting to embezzle whatever money would have been made from it. And it probably really aggravated him that this happened. It probably even aggravates him more about what happens now. But let's go with 6 through 8.
But Jesus said, let her alone. Why do you trouble her? She has done a good work for me. You have the poor with you always, and whatever you wish, you may do them good. But me, you do not have always. She has done what she could. She has come beforehand to anoint my body for burial.
All right, so Jesus, he's not happy with their attitude. She was the only one with the right attitude. She was honoring Jesus while he was still living. Jesus got on them for their lack of foresight. And then he kind of adds a little salt to the wound with verse 9. Somebody read that one.
Verily I say unto you, whosoever this gospel shall be preached throughout the world, of the whole world, this also that she hath done shall be spoken of for a memorial of her.
Not only do they think she's wrong, and Jesus said she's not wrong, but on top of that, every time this gospel is preached, you'll hear about, everybody will hear about this act this woman did. It'll be forever. So he's really showing them how far off they are. Not only what was what she did important and right, but it is used as a lesson for all of us. Nothing given to the Lord for his honor and glory, keep that in mind, is ever wasteful as long as you give with the right attitude. Don't ever think that. Hmm?
This one verse strikes me as very powerful because we are still telling this story right now.
I know. Yeah, isn't that amazing? And the other thing, she did something stupid, and she said, it's not only the right thing to do, they're going to be talking about it years from now. So, good luck with that one, guys. But now, if you think about it, what would you have done differently the last time you saw a loved one who has passed away? This is what Mary's doing. She knows Jesus is going to die. Because Jesus said, she's preparing me for burial already. But what would you do different? If you knew it was the last time you were going to see a person before they died, and you could go back to that one last visit, what would you do different? Think about that. Because, you know, a lot of times we just go on about our business, and then we find out they died. And
if they were saved, I guess I would probably try to spend as much time with them as possible. But if they weren't saved, I'd be trying to get them saved.
I mean, if you knew, I mean, your priorities would shift. It wouldn't be the normal visit you would have with them. It would be all your priorities would change. Mary here had the right priority, so that's all he's pointing out. So you got to give her credit for that and to be willing to spend that kind of money.
Yeah.
So let's go with 10 and 11.
And Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went unto the chief priests to betray him unto them. And when they heard it, they were glad and promised to give him money. And he sought how he might conveniently betray him.
All right. So Judas, who was very materialistic, thought this was both wasteful and it was also the final straw for him.
Yeah.
He was angry and gave the religious leaders just what they hoped for, which was an inside man. And we all know 30 pieces of silver was the price of a slave. That's what he ended up getting, the price of a slave for the Son of God. All right, 12 through 15.
Now on the first day of unleavened bread, when they killed the Passover lamb, his disciples said to him, where do you want us to go and prepare, that you may eat the Passover?
And he sent out two of his disciples and said to them, go into the city, and a man will meet you carrying a pitcher of water. Follow him. Wherever he goes in, say to the master of the house, the teacher says, where is the guest room in which I may eat the Passover with my disciples? Then he will show you a large upper room furnished and prepared there, make it ready for us.
All right, so there is a general consensus among Bible scholars, I guess, that the person they met was possibly the father of John Mark. It could have been one of John Mark's servants, because it says when you get here, ask for the master of the house, but they think it was actually John Mark's dad had gone out to fetch water. I've looked. The Bible says nothing about who this person is. This is only conjecture based on some other things. We know that the upper room, the home with the upper room, was owned by John Mark's parents, and it was a center of activity for the early church. John Mark is also the one who went home early from one of the mission trips with Paul and Barnabas. Paul and Barnabas had a falling out over this, the way Paul got mad and Barnabas defended him, and they kind of split. That part of the story is recorded in the Bible about the split of these two. When you read the story, there's a discharge in the military. I can't remember the number, but we refer to it as the I Miss My Mommy discharge. Some guys join the military and they just can't get over the fact they're not home with their mom. And they whine and cry and they're absolutely worthless, and they finally give them a discharge because of the emotional hardship they're going through being separated from their mom. So we just called it the I Miss My Mommy discharge. We had one guy go home, but kind of what it looks like happened here. It looks like John Mark went out and he kind of missed his mommy. So he wanted to go back home. And he left them in the middle of the missionary journey. It kind of burned a bridge with Paul. Paul had his shoulder to the plow the whole time, and he didn't tolerate people who were half-hearted in their efforts. But that part is recorded about that happening. The reason the Bible never does say exactly why, when you read it, it kind of looks that way. We'll get to another fact about him a little bit later. I'll say that. 16 through 20.
And his disciples went forth and came into the city and found as he had said unto them, and they made ready the Passover. And in the evening he cometh with the 12. And as they sat and did eat, Jesus said, verily I say unto you, one of you which eateth with me shall betray me. And they began to be sorrowful, and to say unto him one by one, is it I? And another said, is it I? And he answered and said unto them, it is one of the 12 that dippeth with me in the dish.
All right, so while they're eating, Jesus makes this shocking announcement that somebody eating with him would be the one who betrayed him. So what was the disciples' reaction?
Wanting to know if it was them.
Yeah, they were kind of concerned about this. What do you mean, one of us? Who is it? Is it me? They were sad about it, too. It says they were sorrowful that somebody was going to do it. What is not in what they are saying? This is a really broad question. What are they not asking?
Who it is.
They are asking, is it I? Is it I? They are kind of asking who it is, but...
Yeah.
They're not pointing the finger at anybody. It wasn't like they all said, Judas, what are you doing? You cannot go out and betray Judas. Judas was not on their radar. They all suspected out of anybody, it might be them personally who betrayed Jesus. They were not. That just shows a wolf in sheep's clothing. Judas was in there the whole time. He was in it for the money. He was in it for personal glory. When that ointment got wasted, in his opinion, is when he decided, I'm just going to go in this. The priest is looking for him anyway. I'll make money off selling him to the priest since they wasted the money on the oil. I mean, but not a single disciple suspected him of that. Not a single one.
So I have a question.
Yes.
So I've heard this teaching that, I don't know if it says, it's not in this gospel, in one of the other ones, that when they all ask, is it I, Lord? And all of them say, Lord, except for Judas, who says, Rabbi or teacher.
I'd have looked at it. That's a good point. I don't know. I never.
Holy that Jesus was the Christ. I don't know. I mean, what do you think?
It could be. I don't. I'm not familiar. I've never looked at that part. I've never compared the Gospels across this. I would usually compare them for more detail, so you can get. But I've never looked at that. But that is. I should have looked at that because that's not an uncommon sign of what's in somebody's heart is how they refer to Jesus. Mm-hmm. So I didn't realize that he didn't call him Lord.
But, you probably wouldn't pick up another because they did call him Rabbi and they did call him teacher.
Well, no, see, but if you remember, Peter was in the boat and when Jesus said, cast your net to the other side, Peter said, I've been fishing here all night, there ain't no fish here. And he said, but whatever. He says, for you, Rabbi, I will do it. For you, teacher. And they threw it in, and when they pulled out that catch of fish, he fell to his knees and called him master. Called him Lord is what he did. So a change of heart happened right there. He went from being a good teacher to being the Lord in that moment. And you see that as people would refer to Jesus, how they referred to him had a lot to do with what they thought of him. So if he did that, I didn't catch he did that, but if he did, that is a good sign. That he did not see him as the Lord. It'd be awful hard to spend that much time with him and not have figured there was something up. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I saw a comic day I thought was pretty funny. It said the disciples secretly asked the little boy if mom could pack nachos and chicken wings next hour for his next lunch. No, but you know, you witness that miracle twice. You would have to think just that alone. But watching people get up and walk and get their sight back and be able to talk and do all that stuff, you would have to say there's something about this guy.
Mm-hmm. But the disciples at one point to do all those things.
They right. So. Yeah, it was a, I don't know. The thing was, he was cool enough at this to not be flagged. You would think, when we think of Judas, we think of this greedy, evil man. But not one of them said, is it Judas? Because we've had our suspicions about Judas. So the person said that. You would think they would have. If he had showed any signs, one of them would have questioned. I don't know. It's kind of interesting, though, the way that worked out. So sometimes even the most evil people can fool you. 21.
The Son of Man indeed goeth as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. Good were it that for that man if he had never been born.
All right, so this verse gives us a good idea of whether Judas ever repented or not. Doesn't look like it. Jesus said it had been better for him if he had never been born. So, I say his penalty is bad. Very bad. Jesus did not make Judas betray him. Judas, it was inside of Judas to do it. Jesus just put him in place so he could do it. But he did not make Judas betray him. Satan, I still think Satan thought he snuck one on the team. I really do. I really think he thought he had got one by. And God said, hey, that's a good idea. I kind of needed somebody on your team to be on the inner circle. So here you go. I don't know. But I don't think he ever repented. And I am curious, you know, we'll never know because Judas died. But he hung himself. But I wonder what would happen if he had lived. I wonder how the other disciples would have treated him. Well, you talk about a lesson in forgiveness. I wonder if they would have. I wonder if that's not why.
They didn't. I think Peter
was. Yeah, I mean, seriously, I'm curious because maybe that's why he wasn't around for any confrontation past that point is because that'd been hard to forgive the guy who betrayed Jesus. I mean, think about that. And to us, it's bad because we have a relationship with Jesus, but could you imagine spending 3 years with him? Mm-hmm. And having him taken from you by one of the inner circle betrayed him, how bad that would actually be. That would be a hard one to forgive for a person, I would think. I don't know. We'll never know that because it didn't happen that way. It was probably good it didn't.
When he came back, he would have told them, you all need to forgive Judas right now. I've had enough.
He probably would have. Hey, he probably would have. He probably said, yeah, forgive him. But, you know, the thing is, would they? Would they? I don't, boy, that would have been a test. That's all I got to say. That would be a test. All right, so let's go on with 22 through 26.
And as they did eat, Jesus took bread and blessed and broke it and gave to them and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." And he took the cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, and they all drank of it. And he said unto them, "This is my blood of the New Testament, which is shed for many. Verily I say unto you, I will drink no more of the fruit of the vine until that day that I drink it new in the kingdom of God." And when they had sung an hymn, they went out into the Mount of Olives.
And that hymn they sang was, "Blessed be the times that bind." No, I'm just kidding. Is that the name of that song? Somebody needs to really tell me the name of that song one day. But that is why we do that after communion. That's why everybody does get together and sing, because that's what they did. They did before they went out. This is where the church ordinance of communion originates. Part of what I read on those communion days is from this very incident right here. There is no record of transubstantiation in the Bible. I don't know. Mike, can you explain what that is?
He probably could.
He probably knows it, as soon as I tell him.
He knows things that nobody knows.
He'll know this one. He's ready to know the full name for it, because that's a weird name. It's hard to even pronounce. Transubstantiation. That's a big word. My 50-cent word for the day. That's where the Catholics believe it actually turns into the body and the blood of Jesus Christ. It's a miracle of transubstantiation. The little wafer becomes the body of Christ, the literal flesh of Jesus, and the wine becomes the literal blood of Jesus. And that's why it might have been your dad. I can't remember. The kids were eating the bread after communion. Was it Charlie?
Yeah.
And got upset. But it's based on that idea of the reverence of the communion, but after communion is over, it's still just bread and grape juice. That's all it is. But for the Catholics, that would be an absolute heresy, and they would probably kick you out of the church for doing such a terrible thing.
Jeff was upset about it, too.
I agree. Because their belief is it actually becomes Jesus, yes.
And I think I saw or something on that only Jesus wine goes into the mouth.
Right, for them, yes.
So we know we can test it or whatever and say,
right,
this is wine or this is
yeah.
How convenient.
Yeah, that's right. It made it impossible to test. That didn't even come about until years later that the Catholic Church instituted. They even did communion. It had nothing to do with that, any of that. They did communion like we do. And at some point along the line, somebody said that, and somebody else goes, "Well, that's a good idea." And then before you knew it, everybody agreed with everybody because the guy who came up with the stupid idea was a good guy, and everybody liked him. That's probably how it got passed. I have no idea how it got passed. But there is no benefit to this, except I know that a lot of times when they drill this into Catholic children, they actually believe that they now have a part of Jesus inside them, and it scares them. So it could be a little bit about control, but I still can't see that being the reason. I don't know. I just know that's what's some who have come out of the Catholic Church have talked about, how they really have a hard time with communion not being the actual body and blood of Jesus. So I don't know. But anyway, Jesus set it up. You see here, he says, "Do this in remembrance of me." He didn't say, "Every time you do this, this becomes my body and my blood." He said, He held up the bread and just said, "This is my body," and he broke it, broken for you. That was an object lesson. That's all he did. He gave an object lesson. Somehow got out of line. But anyway. All right, moving on. We are going to go with 27 and 28.
Then Jesus said to them, "All of you will be made to stumble because of me this night, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee."
All right, so before we discuss these two verses, let's go to Zechariah 13, verse 7. Zechariah 13:7.
"Awake, the sword against my shepherd, and against the man that is my fellow, saith the Lord of hosts. Smite the shepherd, and the sheep shall be scattered, and I will turn my hand upon the little ones.
Okay, so this is what Jesus actually quoted here. They would have known that. On a side note, we're not going to read it, but if you go just a couple of verses down, the Bible says that two-thirds of the people will be cut off. Remember when I was telling you the averages or what the prediction might be in the Bible? At best, it's 50-50. It could be as low as only 25%. This is an illustration of two-thirds will be cut off. Only a third will be saved. But Jesus quotes this, and it was a kind of a warning to the disciples. He was telling them, one of you all will betray me. He's also saying, I will be forsaken by all of you all. There is a thought that he was giving them a warning that when this happens, scatter. Don't get caught up in the dragnet. Just scatter. Could have been the thought. I'll talk about that later, probably in a sermon, because that's a totally different topic. But there was somebody in that group who famously disagreed with Jesus. Somebody read 29.
Peter said to him, even if all are made to stumble, yet I will not be.
Okay, yeah, you have to love Peter's confidence and enthusiasm. His ego's really starting to show through, right? You know, and I sometimes think of just the comedy of denying you're going to be a denier. I mean, you're kind of already doing it. But I wonder what Jesus thought of that, because Jesus knew all, and he looks at Peter, and he knows Peter means well. You know, but he also knows Peter's going to flunk this test. So it's kind of a sad situation to be in, I think. But anyway, let's just see. Jesus goes a little further. So go ahead and read verse 30.
And Jesus saith unto him, verily I say unto thee, that this day, even in this night, before the cock crow twice, thou shalt deny me thrice.
All right, so he says, I'll never betray you. Jesus refines the prediction. Now he talks specifically to Peter, and he says, you will deny me three times. Three times.
Yeah.
And, you know, Peter knows Jesus. He knows that Jesus knows things that people don't know. And you think that he would have accepted that, but what's he do? He doubled down. Go with 31.
If I should die with thee, I will not deny thee in any wise. Likewise, also said they all.
All right, so Peter seemed kind of shocked that Jesus would think that he, the most ardent disciple, the one who loves him more, would ever sink to that level of disrespect. What goes before fall?
Pride.
Pride. I think some pride's getting in the way here. He means well, but he stumbles like all of us do from time to time. So let's go 32.
Came to the place which was named Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, sit here while I pray.
All right, so Jesus left most of the disciples there. He didn't ask them to pray. He did the inner circle, but not the general circle here. But he had already prayed with them, so he just wanted to just take a seat. He had some further business to do with God the Father, and it was pointed out that what we can learn from this is that public prayer and worship does not excuse us from our private time with the Lord. So he still, after all the public stuff with his disciples, he's still seeking time alone with God. We should follow that example. 33 and 34.
And he took Peter, James, and John with him, and began to be troubled and deeply distressed. Then he said to them, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch.
All right, so he took Peter, James, and John. Now, they were the inner circle. They were the first circle of three. As you move out, the next circle of three had a different function. They all, I think we talked about that in a disciple study one time. But anyway, why these three? Not really favorites. That's a good point, but not really. That's not quite what it is. What are these three kind of known for?
Outspoken.
Outspoken. That's a good way to put it. James and John were called what? Sons of Thunder. And Peter is the one who just stood up and said he would never deny Jesus. And let's go look here at Mark 10. Well, I tell you what, we're not going to go there because there's a lot of verses yet. This is where James and John said, we want to sit on your right and your left. And Jesus said, you know not what ye ask. Can you drink of the cup that I drink of and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? And they said unto him, we can. Peter just said, I'll stick with you to the end. These guys said, we can go through what you're going through. Jesus pulls him in a little closer so they get a better view of what is going on this night. It's probably why they were there. They were the most boastful of the group about being able to stand strong and stay true. All right, so let's go with 35 and 36.
And he went forward a little and fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, Abba, Father, all things are possible unto thee. Take away this cup from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what thou wilt.
All right, so Jesus is not looking forward to this agonizing death he was about to experience. You got to remember, he was fully human, so that means he felt what we feel. That means he felt every bite of that whip, the cat of nine tails. He felt every thorn in the crown they beat on his head. He felt every punch, every slap, everything they did to him. He felt it all. The human side preferred to pass. But he was obedient unto his Father, even unto death. In Philippians 2:8, I'll read that one. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. You got to think about that. In the past, I have used the John Wayne movie, J.D. Cahill, U.S. Marshal, if y'all remember that one. He has a half-breed Indian friend, and his Indian friend gets shot by one of his boys. He went to scare his boys, but I'm shot the end in, and he's sitting on the ground leaning against a tree, and he's screaming in agony, and John Wade rises up and says, I thought you Indians didn't feel any pain. He said, the Indian side of me doesn't. He said, but the white man side's killing me. It's kind of the way it was Jesus. He was all God, but he was also all human, and he was going to feel this. He didn't go through this as a painless thing. He felt every bit of it. All of us would have said, if there's any other way, I'd like to talk about that option now. But that's what he's doing. So let's go with 37 and 38.
Then he came and found them sleeping and said to Peter, Simon, are you sleeping? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak.
There's a saying you hear in our normal conversations. Spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak.
Yeah.
He was already showing them that they could not go through what he was about to go through. They couldn't even stay awake and pray. He singled out one here. He singled out Peter. He said, you tell me you're never going to back away, and yet here you are sleeping. So he knew they didn't mean to fail him, but their priorities were a bit different from Jesus because they didn't know everything. Jesus was about to be sacrificed, but they didn't fully fathom any part of this. They still had trouble wrapping their mind around that. So let's go with 39 and 40.
Again, he went away and prayed and spoke the same words. And when he returned, he found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy. And they did not know what to answer him.
Yep, so that's pretty cut and dry. He went back, they were asleep. Wouldn't have mattered, they had no idea what to say or how to help anyway, so Jesus went back to pray alone one more time. 41.
And he cometh the third time and saith to them, sleep on now and take your rest. It is enough. The hour is come. Behold, the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners.
So he found them asleep the third time he came back, and he... To him, it was good they got some rest because things were going to get a lot worse coming up and it was going to be a long night. So, but the activities were about to start, so he has to get them up. So let's go 42 through 46.
Rise up, let us go. Lo, he that betrayeth me is at hand. And immediately, while he yet spake, cometh Judas, one of the 12, and with him a great multitude with swords and staves from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. And he that betrayed him had given them a token, saying, whomsoever I shall kiss, that same is he. Take him and lead him away safely. And as soon as he was come, he goeth straightway to him and saith, Master, Master, and kissed him. And they laid their hands on him and took him.
So Judas had this predetermined sign. The kiss was a common greeting in that culture. It showed respect or that you honored somebody or that you loved somebody. However, Judas chose this because it would seem normal. But instead of love and honor, it signified betrayal. And betrayal always comes from somebody who is closest to you.
Yeah.
You got to be careful of that. Jesus was not surprised by this act. In fact, he called Judas his betrayer before he even got there. He said, look, here comes my betrayer now. That kiss, though, has become a sign of betrayal or a bad sign, especially if you know anything about the mob. You don't want to be on the receiving end of one of those Judas kisses there. Not good for you. 47.
And one of them that stood by drew a sword and smote a servant of the high priest and cut off his ear.
All right, so Peter is the one who drew the sword and he cut off Malchus's ear. His name is Malchus. Jesus actually reattached it and told Peter to stand down, but at least Peter did try to do something at this point. He did step up. He just was behaving completely incorrectly. There was a time for standing up, but this was actually a time where Jesus was to fulfill the prophecy of his crucifixion. So it had to happen. Let's go with 48 through 50.
And Jesus answered and said unto them, are ye come out as against a thief with swords and with staves to take me? I was daily with you in the temple teaching, and ye took me not, but the scriptures must be fulfilled. And they all forsook him and fled.
Okay, there they all scattered. All the disciples scattered at that point. Jesus kind of poked fun at the big showing. They had their religious leaders, they had their temple guards, and they even had a legion of Roman soldiers. Depending on the account, between 600 to 1,000 men showed up. After the little altercation, all the disciples scattered. But Jesus said, I was in the temple. You all heard me talk. You all never tried to take me before, but you come out here in the middle of the night. Bit overkill, guys. That's probably what he was saying to them in their language. I don't know how to. But anyway, 51 and 52.
Now a certain young man followed him, having a linen cloth thrown around his naked body. And the young man laid a hold of him and left. And he left the linen cloth and fled from the naked.
All right, so it is believed this young, they know this young man's name. It is not in the Bible. Again, this is not biblical, but this is what history and research has made the general consensus. Who do y'all think it was? John Mark. John Mark is the man whose parents had the upper room. He had followed from his parents' house is what he had done. He was completely unprepared for what was going to happen, but he went along just out of youthful curiosity. He wanted to see what was going to happen. Who can tell me something more about John Mark besides his parents owned the upper room and he went on a missionary trip? And
writer of
this
gospel.
He is the writer of this gospel. John is his Jewish name. Mark is his Roman name, which means he was a Roman citizen like Paul, even though he lived in Jerusalem, but he wrote this gospel. So this is the young man. We don't know where he actually came into Jesus' life, but it could have been the very fact that he used his house for the Last Supper. And he just saw everything going on and tagged along, saw this happen. Got more involved in the ministry. He became a leader in the early church. It is believed that the night Peter got away from the jail and Rhoda thought it was his ghost. You all remember that? They're having a prayer meeting praying for Peter's release and Peter knocks on the door and Rhoda thinks it's his ghost. And well, Rhoda goes upstairs and tells them Peter's at the door and he said it's not him, it's his ghost. Shows what faith they had in thinking he could be turned free. But anyway, they believe John Mark was in that meeting. It was his house. It was his parents' house. He was a leader. So he was probably there for that even. He turns out to be a pretty big player, but at the time this happened, he would have been a very small incidental person. That's why they believe this is him writing about himself, because otherwise everybody else skipped it because he wasn't that important. 53 and 54.
They led Jesus away to the high priest, and with him were assembled all the chief priests, the elders, and the scribes. But Peter followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest. Then he sat with the servants and warmed himself at the fire.
Okay, so he followed at a distance what he thought was a safe distance. Probably wasn't. Let's go with 55.
Now the chief priests and all the council saw testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none.
All right, so they were looking for somebody to testify against Jesus. Yeah. They couldn't find anybody. They were even willing to talk to false witnesses, and they still found none. But let's go with 56 through 59. You'll see what I meant there.
For many bear false witness against him, but their witness agreed not together. And there arose certain and bear false witness against him, saying, "We heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands." But neither so did their witness agree together.
So, like most lies, there is an element of the truth. Jesus spoke something similar to this phrase. It wasn't quite the phrase he said, though. This guy made it more, they understood what he said to mean the actual temple building, but Jesus never referred to the temple building. And if you go back, you'll see the difference in what these two sayings are. That's why the witnesses couldn't even agree if that's what he said. They couldn't agree on anything. At this point, they couldn't accept that as evidence or as testimony against a criminal in a trial because there wasn't two or three witnesses in agreement. They tried, but they couldn't quite make it. So let's go with 60 and 61.
And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, "Answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witnesses against thee?" But he held his peace and answered nothing. Again, the high priest asked him and said unto him,
"Art thou the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" There you go. How's that? You ripped that page out of your Bible. You must not like that one.
There we go. "Art thou the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?"
There you go. All right.
I got it.
Jesus didn't even give the liars the courtesy of acknowledging them and what they said. He just stayed silent. This meant that the high priest had to directly question him, hoping to trip him up. So he says, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" 62 through 64.
Jesus said, "I am, and ye shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest rent his clothes and said, "What need we any further witnesses? Ye have heard the blasphemy. What think ye?" And they all condemned him to be guilty of death.
All right, so in a real court of law, that question would have been leading. If Jesus has had a lawyer, he would have stood up and said, "Objection, leading question." He could have said, "Who are you?" or "Who do you say you are?" But he said, "Are you?" and he said what the answer was. But Jesus didn't care because he was actually correct. So Jesus said, "Yes, I am." He confirmed this with the exact words God said to Moses from the burning bush, "I am." Immediately, the Jews knew at that point that he was claiming to be God. And that would have been blasphemy if you weren't actually God. So that's why the priest was so quickly able to call for his death.
But it was a kangaroo court.
Well, it was. It was in a legal court all the way across.
We at night, and then, not in Mark, but I think some of the other gospels say that not all the Sanhedrin were there.
Right. They left some out who were on.
So, and then I know why. And the fact that they had a question him says that means they didn't have two witnesses against them.
I was going to say, the witnesses, they couldn't get to two or three to make it work. Yeah.
At night, in a kangaroo court.
Right. But that's why it was, that's but Jesus answered, because first off, his goal is to get to the cross. That's what he's here for. But in his answer, he claimed to be God in the flesh. And that's when they said, oh, blasphemy, put to death. All right, so let's look at how the crowd reacted in 65.
And some began to spit on him and to cover his face and to buffet him and to say unto him, prophesy, and the servants did strike him with the palms of their hands.
All right, so this crowd is the same crowd who had welcomed him with open arms a week ago, is now condemning him and attacking him. You got to remember, public opinion is never a good gauge of truth. Public opinion sways all the time. 66 to 68.
And as Peter was beneath in the palace, there cometh one of the maids of the high priest. And when she saw Peter warming himself, she looked upon him and said, and thou also wast with Jesus of Nazareth. But he denied, saying, I know not, neither understand I what thou sayest. And he went out onto the porch, and the cock crew.
All right, so Peter, without hesitation, denies he knows Jesus. So he decides, though, the best thing to do is put some distance between him and this maid. So he tries to leave, you know, out of sight, out of mind. It'll go away. Let's go with 69 and 70.
And the girl saw him again and began to say to those who stood by, this is one of them. But he denied it again. And a little later, those who stood by said to Peter again, surely you are one of them, for you are a Galilean, and your speech shows it.
All right, so it is it is not the same maid. The lady who confronted him the first time was a maid of the high priest, right? And this is another maid of the high priest. The third person who confronts him is Malchus's relative. That's the third person. That happens even a little bit later. The way this is put together here, it looks like it happened just really quick. But they were spaced apart. They were different people each time. So Peter, thinking he got away clean, goes out, and another one of the maids seeing calls him out. He denies it. That was denial number two. He moves on again. Now he's warming himself by the fire when, like I say, Malchus's relative spots him and questions him for the third time, and his answer grew even more defiant. His denial was even worse. 71 and 72.
But he began to curse and to swear, saying, I know not this man of whom you speak. And the second time the cock crew. And Peter called to mind the words of Jesus, said unto him, before the cock crows twice, thou shalt deny me thrice. And when he thought thereon, he wept.
All right, so Luke adds a special detail in his account in Luke 22, verse 61. Happens right after the denial. 22:61.
And the Lord turned and looked upon Peter, and Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had said unto him, before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice.
When he denied him the third time, Jesus looked at him. Everything that was going on with Jesus and everything that was going on with the crowd that was between him and everything, Jesus and Peter locked eyes for just a brief moment. You can imagine how embarrassed Peter felt, and the pain he felt for being the one who actually did do it after he doubled down so much as that he wouldn't. But can you imagine that look of disappointment in Jesus' eyes when he looked across, and the sorrow? I mean, he would have been disappointed. He also would have felt sorry for Peter because he knew what Peter was probably going through at that moment. But now I want you to imagine if you could see Jesus' face every time you disappoint him. Wouldn't that change things?
Sorry, but it would.
He'd just take a picture and send it to you. Say, put this on your phone, Jerry. Now you pick it up. It's me looking disappointed in you. I'm just kidding. Just kidding, Gary.
Peter, at least he was there. Where were the other apostles?
Well, we don't have a record of where they were, but we do know one of them stayed to the end. One of them did stay to the end. We're not there yet. So.
Well, they did what Jesus said, scatter.
Actually, and there's a reason. Like I say, I'll probably do a sermon. We'll talk about what was really happening in that part of it. But if you look at this now, Peter became an extremely strong, outspoken advocate for the gospel from there on. He never made that mistake again. He stood fearless against the priests, the religious leaders, you know, the Roman soldiers. It didn't matter who spoke to him. He held his ground. He went to jail for it. He said, I would rather obey God than obey you. I mean, he became pretty strong. So I guess he learned from that mistake and vowed never do it again, probably. I mean, he learned, so got to give him credit.
I like what you said, because in both of those accounts that you read, Peter cried, and how when we disappoint Christ, if we're not weeping and asking for forgiveness, and, you know, then we do need to check our heart.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah. Just
yeah, actually, I'm glad we can't see him every time we disappoint him, because, of course, it might make us better Christians. Probably would if we actually knew exactly what. To us, we're one step removed from things like that. You know what I mean? But for Peter, he's, you know, he was adamant. He was not going to deny Jesus. So he's embarrassed over saying, "I'm going to be the one who stands strong," and then he's heartbroken over the fact he did.
And he wasn't as prideful.
No. Actually, when...
failing that bad makes you pretty humble.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you're going to fail, I mean, that was a spectacular fail. It really was. It was a... Jesus, we'll talk about it when we get to it, Jesus restores him in a certain way that cancels out this one. We'll talk about that in a later one. Does anybody else have anything to add to this one? Yes, ma'am.
Was it some kind of a legal reason that Judas had to kiss him? Because everyone knew who Jesus was at that point, right?
No, that was the odd thing. They all knew who Jesus was. That was the other thing I didn't point out. We run short on time there. But he still said, just to be sure, I'm going to kiss the one. Now, the priest would have known him, but the Roman soldiers may not have. They might not have known which one was Jesus. So he had to do something. He couldn't walk up and say, it's that one right there. He had to walk up and make it look natural. So he just gave him a kiss like he always did. I don't know how natural you could be walking up with 1,000 Roman soldiers behind you and all the temple guards and the priest. It's not. I'm just out for a stroll in the garden at midnight. All of us. We all were restless. Yeah. But that was what he chose to do. So he definitely changed the meaning of that, though. Before that, that was never a kiss of betrayal. That was always a kiss of honor and love. And that one act has changed it forever. And I do like what Ray Comfort said. He said, the Bible says that there will never, the line of Judas Iscariot will die. There will be no more. And he said, every town he's ever traveled in worldwide, he gets out a phone book and he looks, and there's never been an Iscariot in the phone book.
Right.
Oh, nobody named Iscariot alive today.
That's interesting. That was such a big thing that day. I was just doing research on it for Bible study. The place where he hung himself is still called after his name, Judas Iscariot in Hebrew.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. The priest bought that field. Well, supposedly, we don't know for sure. They think that field is where they bury people and indigent people. The people who couldn't afford a burial became Potter's Field. Anyway, anybody else have anything else? All right.